Welcome to The Sound of Economics and to Bruegel's podcast. Today we discuss the global economic situation with a particular focus on the EU-China economic relations at a time of rising trade tensions between all the three countries, China, US, and Europe. We are delighted. We just had a big event with a number of very senior Chinese officials and Chinese thinkers here at our venue, and we are delighted, therefore, to now host Professor Zhang Weiwei. He is at the China Institute of the Fudan University and is, of course, a very well-known scholar on these questions. So, Mr. Zhang, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, with pleasure.
Yeah. And I would like to perhaps ask you, what do you think are the main takeaways from our today's discussion that comes really at a very critical moment for the global economic system?
I think we had a long and roving discussions on many issues relating to trilateral relations between China, EU, and the United States. And I find that we have a lot of common ground, especially on the issue of multilateralism, on the issue of open trading system. And there are differences between Chinese and EU experts on some issues, for instance, whether China is a developing country or a developed country, or the China model of development and state-owned enterprises. On these issues, there are differences. But I think, you know, there is a Chinese saying, we can seek common grounds while reserving our differences and then move ahead rather than being, you know, blocked by our differences. I think this morning when Mr. Van Hongpei made a point, he said, you know, we are both committed to multilateralism and we have different political systems and behind these are different values, but we can withhold our judgment, let time to judge. This is also a view most Chinese share. I may use this opportunity to explain briefly the Chinese political system, because which has not been fully understood in the West, in Europe as well. The Chinese state is very unique, because if you look at the size of China, it's roughly, in terms of population, equivalent to 100 European states put together. In Europe, a country has a population average 14 million, China 1.4 billion. So I call China as a civilizational state, which is a continuous civilization, uninterrupted for thousands of years, and then it's mingled with a super large modern state. It's almost like Roman Empire that has continued to this day. People have diverse cultures, regions, dialects, and traditions, yet people speak the same language, Latin. We call Mandarin Chinese. Yeah. So to govern this kind of country, since China was first unified over 2,000 years ago, to be precise, in 221 BC, China began to pursue a kind of one-party system, what we call the unified ruling entity. Otherwise, the country will split, become ungovernable. So in China's long history, the country occasionally disintegrated. But in the end, you know, people still seek common ground and try to have unification. So this is a very strong message. If in the West, legitimacy is about and one person, one vote, and you get elected. In the Chinese case, legitimacy is about performance, about whether you can really keep the country united. Because in China's long history, this kind of unity helps China to overcome difficulties. Even ancient times, two China's major rivers, Yangtze River and the Yellow River, runs across much of China. They have floods, you know, flooding every year. So in order coordinating fighting against floods or flood control, you need to have a central government relatively strong. It has to go beyond provinces. So this tradition has established itself. And so now China has evolved from this tradition. So I call this a mixture of tradition and modernity. For instance, as I said this morning, you know, we have a system, I call this selection plus election. Yeah. In the West, it's about election. In the Chinese, you have to be, you know, extremely competent governor for provinces at least twice, you know, in order to be nominated as one of the top leaders. So the leadership is extremely competent. This is a general consensus in China. And otherwise, the country becomes ungovernable. Now, we come to this major issue under discussion today, the trade war between, especially in the China United States. We think, you know, the United States under Donald Trump has made a huge strategic mistake in terms of fighting trade war against China. Actually, both sides have agreed to expand their trade. China will buy more goods from the United States, a huge market. We can afford purchasing more. If the United States allows to buy high-tech products, the balance can be immediately redressed. But the United States is unwilling to do that. And then the Trump began to launch this high tariff. Maybe today he will say, tariff on worth of $200 billion of goods. But we made a calculation, and this worst scenario, there are no Sino-US trade, China's overall GDP will be affected only by 0.5%. So it's half of 1%. So China's GDP growth this year is projected to be 6.5 minimum. So it will be still around 6. Because China has started its economic restructuring since the financial crisis of the United States 2008. At that time, China's trade dependency was 70% of its GDP. Today, it's less than 10% of its GDP. And furthermore, the Chinese domestic consumption is gaining momentum. Yeah. In the first half of this year, it's an increase of 70.8%, which nearly 80% of the growth comes from domestic consumption, which is remarkable, which means the early signs of the success in economic restructuring. It's more consumer-driven, consumption-driven, rather than trade-driven. As a result, we're not afraid of this war. I think trade war is undermining the interests of both countries, or if it's Europe, third party as well. But I think the United States will lose more. Why? Because China is becoming the world's largest consumer market. This year it will be the largest, I think, $6 trillion a year. And this is also calculated in terms of US dollar official exchange rate. If you really recalculate this in purchasing power parity, it's even much bigger. And if you look at the internet economy, it's China's mobile payment now is over 50% of the 50 times of the United States. Behind this, mainly driven by consumptions. And I don't know, Donald Trump launched this war, but how he would put an end to this war.
Right. I think, of course, the concern that many have is that while it is true that China is a huge market and has a lot of consumption and a lot of domestic growth, access for foreign firms into China is difficult, and there is a discrimination between Chinese companies and European or US companies. there's a significant worry in a number of quarters. And by the way, there was an official statement by the U.S. Trade official, Lighthizer, Cecilia Malmström, and also the Japanese trade official, trade minister, worrying about technology, forced technology transfer when one wants to invest in China. And the economy, of course, has significant elements of state-owned enterprise and, you know, difficulties to actually tap this consumption market to the extent European and American firms would like to do it. Now, China has been promising reforms. For example, there was the important speech in Davos by President President Xi. But progress by people that are on the ground and, you know, look at this on the ground, such as the European Chamber of Commerce, suggest that progress is quite slow. And so I think we need more time to sort that out, but people are getting impatient. So perhaps we need more patience, or how do we approach this issue?
Well, as I said, China is a vast country, the size of 100 average European states. So some patience maybe is worthwhile. But on the other hand, you know, those brave guys will be rewarded, as shown in the past four decades. There are now a lot of young Europeans, you know, in Shanghai, in Shenzhen. You know, they just came here without any whatever preconceived idea. They just come here and then start whatever enterprises, you know, in Shanghai, in Shenzhen. And they do quite well, actually, because there are key difference between the Chinese culture and the European culture. European culture is very legalistic. Essentially, you have very clear rules before you really make investment. The Chinese culture is very much experimental and gradualist approach. I cite this example of the Chinese economic model, what we call socialist market economy. At the very beginning, you know, in 1978, exactly four decades ago, when Deng Xiaoping started this reform and opening up, he did not have a roadmap, but he provides an orientation, what we call the compass, yeah, which means fighting poverty, improving people's living standards, and hopefully more market-oriented. And then 14 years into reform, with all kinds of experiments, special zones, and then a model gradually emerged called a mixed economy, a socialist market. Same with now this Belt and Road Initiative. We put this grand, you know, orientation along these roads. We promote trade, you know, links between companies, between, you know, traders and even digital industries. And then we don't have a roadmap, but we have this compass. Yeah, so that you can promote this links and prosperity along the road, we encourage. And gradually a roadmap, a legal system will come into force. So really, the system is more rewarding to those who have the guts, and which is the case in China over the past four decades. Yeah. Gradually, something more sophisticated will emerge. Yeah, I think this is the case. And as for reforms, China is arguably the best reformer, although it's still slow in the eyes of many people. If you look at the United States, when Obama came to power, he championed change. 8 years after his presidency, he only got one change, this medical system. And then when Donald Trump came to power, it's already abandoned. If you look at China, it's reform in each and every field, all the way, you know, from the college examination system to state-owned enterprises to the government service to military reform. It's large scale reforms, yeah. And the part you mentioned only one small part of it, yeah. But it's still going on, yeah.
Well, what would be your prediction for the relations and the on the global trade relations in the coming years? I mean, what do you think?
We still think in terms of the trilateral relations between China, Europe, and the United States. China is the country that has always supported EU and Euros and European solidarity, whether the EU is in its better time or worse time. So this consistent policy. In contrast, I feel that the United States is not doing this way. Of course, it's up to EU to decide, you know, who is the real friend, you know. And we have a strategic way of thinking, you know, European should get more united so that it will become major pole in international relations and the world will become safer. Same with economic relations. We also think Europeans are simply too proud, too sophisticated to accept the American whatever, to play a role of a small brother for the United States. No, I don't think so. But Europeans have their problems at home, whether it's refugee crisis, populism, and EU bureaucracy, whatever. But we have patience. I think if you look at the pace of Sino-EU trade and the pace of the expansion of Asia's economy, including Japan, Southeast Asia, South Korea as a whole, I think Europe will increasingly moving towards Asia. Actually, EU-Asia trade, including trade with China, has been growing much faster than that between United States and EU. Of course, we also hope to develop good relations, trading relations with the United States. But now we have the Trump phenomenon. What can we do? So perhaps one day this guy is, for some reason, lost his power. We can rebuild a better trilateral relations.
Professor Zhang, thank you very much for these insights. I'm now joined by Alicia Garcia Herrero, a senior fellow here at Bruegel, who is actually based in Hong Kong and knows the Chinese economy really well and knows China really well. Alicia, we've just heard from Professor Zhang his takeaway. So perhaps I can ask you to give us your main takeaways on where we should be heading, where we will be heading, and what should be Europe's strategy going forward.
Thank you, Guntram. I guess the discussion today was really more about China and Europe, but we can't forget that it all starts from the US. And the discussions were, in a way, a response to U.S. pressure on China, to a lesser extent, U.S. pressure on Europe, which we have also felt. So my reading of this U.S.-China trade war is first that the U.S. is not really only looking at the fiscal, at the trade deficit whatsoever, or even at midterm elections. It's much more than that. It's the U.S. trying to contain China in its move up the ladder and in its technological advance progress. So so this is the first thing. The first $50 billion tariff package is really geared towards that higher end of China's export capacity. And the second $200 billion that is about to be implemented is much more about something that China really does very well, which is being the sourcing power of the world, i.e. The exporter of intermediate products for the rest of the world to complete or to finalize. And in that regard, I think the US is clearly targeting that production capacity that China has in the global value chain to try to dismantle it and send it elsewhere, reshore either to the US or at least re-offshore elsewhere. In perhaps countries where the U.S. has more of a take and on those economies, for example, Mexico or Vietnam. So China's reaction to that is obviously, I need to move faster. If that's what the U.S. wants from me, the only thing I can do is to move up the ladder even faster than I would have done without the U.S. pressure. And this brings China to us, Europe, in terms of acquisitions of technology, especially on the industrial space, which is the heart of China's manufacturing 2025 strategy. So Europe is, I would put it, a sourcing venue for China's upgraded technology to achieve its dream, which is this value, higher value added.
So this is why China is investing more in Europe, and it's investing which kind of sectors in Europe? You said mostly industrial sectors, and why they don't invest in the US industrial sectors. Can you say a few words on that?
Sure. They used to invest as much in Europe as in the US in the industrial sector. The problem is that it is radically closed now for China to invest in the US. So there's been not a single transaction, M&A or acquisition from China in the US on the industrial space this year, meaning 2017, the data available, while there's been massive acquisitions in Europe. So I think this shows already where we stand as regards this trade war. Europe stands as a source for China to rush to become what the US does not want China to become. And this explains also how the US could react towards the EU. The US could argue that we're not being helpful in China's containment. And by not being helpful, this could have consequences. It could be trade policy, it could be the very surely feared import tariffs on European auto parts or any other type of measure against Europe. But I would argue that these measures in themselves could be seen as a reaction to Europe's open hands. Maybe we are not fully aware of what's happening, but I think it is helping China move up the ladder. And I think this is something that the US could consider, you know, problematic in its attempt to contain China. So that's where Europe gets in the picture of this trade war. We could, of course, we are losers of any trade war because we are a major net exporter. But even if some sectors could, you know, win here and there, and you can think of the usual suspects, those that could step into the tariffs imposed either by the US or China, so aerospace or auto parts, etc. The reality is that still today, the US market is bigger for us than China. During our seminar, we heard that we should not think this way because China's market is so much bigger, because these are, you know, the 1.3 billion consumers in the world, probably. But what really matters for European businesses today is what they see already in their P&L. And that's not yet China, it's much more the US. So I think they, beyond our transatlantic alliance, the European business, and let alone, of course, the government, but especially the business, do not yet see all of those opportunities that China claims it has for us. So I guess the takeaway for me of this seminar, really the key takeaway, is how can China create more of an enticement for European businesses so that those businesses can either lobby or at least make a much stronger point to our governments that there's a lot to lose if we were to align closer with the US. But for that, really, China has to open up much faster than what we, or at least I think I have heard during our exchange of views. We still get this idea that China is still a developing economy, that, you know, it's done a lot in 40 years. It will do more, but it will do it slowly and at its own pace.
So can we talk perhaps 2-3 minutes about this opening up and giving market access? I mean, there's, I guess, various dimensions to this. One important question is, do European companies that operate in the Chinese market, do they face the same conditions as Chinese companies operating in the Chinese market? I think for Europe, we have pretty clear rules that an American company operating in Europe or a Chinese company operating in Europe has to fulfill all the same criteria, has the same access to state aid, has the same access to specific markets and so on. Now, in China, that doesn't seem to be the case. There seems to be a strong bias towards basically more or less state-owned enterprises, be it on the financing side, but also be it on consumer markets specifically, or is it on the financing? You mentioned a very strong figure. Perhaps you can talk a bit about that figure, but also what in terms of access to consumer markets?
Well, China's economic model is still dominated by the state on its on the production side of rather than the welfare side, as it could be the case of Europe. So the role of the state for us is basically provision of services to the households or to the citizens, while the role of the state in China is much more geared towards the actual production of goods to Chinese citizens and beyond, you know, increasingly beyond. The Belt and Road Initiative being one of the landmarks of that idea of going beyond. And if you look at the role of state-owned companies in that beyond, i.e. in the acquisitions, not only of industrial technology in Europe, in which they are also the dominant player, but also in the Belt and Road Initiative, in all of the acquisitions there. So it's really a model of state-owned production. Now, of course, one should realize that this is not as strong in every sector, but I would disagree with the idea that the new economy is actually minimizing the role of the state, because there are many, many sectors that are considered new economy, for example, tourism, or let alone health and education, that are still massively dominated by the state. So yes, the consumer, the Chinese consumer, is still predominantly, and with some exceptions, ICT, digital economy, where the role of the state is less apparent directly, but they are still dominated by the state. So for a foreigner operating in China, I think the problem is not only market access, which has been, frankly speaking, it's been opening for the last 2 years, and in particular in the last 6 months as a response to the trade war, with very specific measures, the opening up of the financial sector and even the easing of acquisitions of Chinese companies by foreigners in the stock market. However, always with the very obvious exception of strategic sectors, which are so many that I would not be able to name them all in this podcast. So I guess the answer is yes, they're opening, but it's not a kind of a multilateral and broad-based opening. It's a targeted opening. This actually could help European companies, because that targeted open might, if we know how to play our cards, be more geared towards European companies than American companies. We saw the case of BASF in Guangdong with a very large which has been granted the permission to build a massive plant. I think it's something like a 10 billion investment. So will we hear more of those cases in which China opens in a more targeted way towards European businesses to kind of help Europe move slightly more on their side in this trade or economic war, or basically economic war with the US? Now, is that enough for Europe, though? Is that targeted opening enough? And my answer is, with that economic model in which you still have massive state ownership, you're bound not to be very successful in that market, even if they open up. So opening is a necessary condition, but it might not be a sufficient condition.
You mentioned the banking. So now you can acquire 51% majority in the banking sector, but I mean in a bank. But basically, the banking sector is dominated by state-owned banks that give preferential credit to state-owned enterprises. Undercutting lending conditions, making it basically an impossible market to be attractive for foreign investors.
Yes, in a blog that we published in Bruegel recently, we actually show that not only is the banking sector state-owned dominated even today, 50 plus the large state-owned commercial banks, but we also have on top of that two massive development banks, China Development Bank and Exim Bank, and even many of the joint stock commercial banks and the city commercial banks are still owned to a large extent by local governments. But as if that were not enough, the numbers show that the cost to income of a foreign bank in China is double as high as a Chinese bank. And that the ROA, so the return on assets, is half that of a Chinese bank. So which kind of foreign bank will now, even if open, they're going, let alone the fact that the cost of capital for European banks and generally foreign banks are so much higher than it was before the financial crisis, and that Chinese banks are so much larger than they were before the financial crisis. So in other words, our target has become bigger, we've become smaller and weaker, and on top of that, foreign banks operating in China today make so much less money than, on average, than a Chinese bank. So this is the idea of a necessary but not sufficient condition. Opening is not the only answer to why European business is really not, is hesitant still today to get into China. So much more needs to be done for us to have a real business cooperation, I'm afraid.
So perhaps to conclude, I mean, it's a rather grim picture that in many respects you are drawing. What do you think will be the strategic sort of final words that I think we should be considering on this relationship? I mean, are we doomed for being squeezed in a trade war between the US and China, or how can we sort of still extract some benefits for the Europeans?
I think Europe is for once in a slightly better situation than China, frankly speaking, because to be squeezed I guess this is much more about squeezing China than about squeezing us, the US strategy. So that is the starting part of the story. So the question is, how can we use our balancing power with the US and China in a way that we don't feel squeezed? I think this is the way to go. And to do that, we need to raise the stakes with China, because China is indeed cornered by the US. And I think today's discussion really reflected that fear. So as a rising hegemon, China needs Europe more than ever. It might be coincidental, it might be, it might not be because of our own power, but nobody should care about why this is the case. We should care about what to get out of this situation, which coincidentally puts us in the middle of this trade war, and we need to leverage from it. And I think from the Chinese side, I can't discuss much about the US side, but from the Chinese side, I do see space, because they are looking for us. They came all the way to Brussels, let's face it. They are looking for us. They want answers. They want to know what we want from them. So now we need to actually be able to state what we want from them, because this is the time for us to have this discussion. It was impossible before. I think it is now somewhat possible because of the pressure from the US.
That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thank you so much, Alicia, for your clear and wise words. We will have to think further about what we really want from China, and please stay tuned to the Bruegel website, where we will publish more on this and inspire the discussion further.